Hello, I'm Eric Topol, Editor-in-Chief of Medscape, and I'm really delighted to welcome Beth Stevens from the Broad Institute and Harvard and Children's Hospital in Boston. And we're going to be talking about some of the great work you've been doing. So welcome, Beth.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Sure. I know you were, I guess, a Massachusetts native, so you're kind of a full loop back to where you started.
Back home, exactly.
And you were at University of Maryland for your PhD?
Mm-hmm. Well, yep. Actually, I was at the NIH before that as a technician with Doug Fields for a number of years. And I really got the science bug and neurobiology bug in his lab. And then at the time, I'd already been invested for so many years in the lab that I started my PhD, and it worked out really well that I could get my degree through Maryland and stay at the NIH to do my research.
Wow, that's, I didn't realize that. Then you went on to Stanford?
Exactly.
And what did you do there?
Yeah, so when I was in Doug's lab, one of the things that was really exciting, it was a very sort of new field, this idea that glial cells, which are the other half of the brain, most of the time people weren't really thinking about glia as doing anything except sort of supporting the neurons. But right around that time, there was some really exciting work being done, and this got me interested in studying glia. And the work I did with Doug was looking at the role of glial cells during development. And then that led me to Ben Barris, who is the sort of another pioneer in the glial field, to do my postdoctoral work. And that's what kind of led me into thinking about glia in the context of synapses and connectivity and brain development in a new way.
So all these people were zooming in on neurons, and you're working on the other space in some respect.
Exactly.
Finding out what's going on there. Now, you're a product of a principal and a school teacher, is that right?
That's
your
right.
Father and your mother, respectively.
Mm-hmm.
And they must have been very interested how you followed a path that was very different in their world of education, I guess.
Huh? Right. I mean, I think, you know, I always was interested in science, I think just naturally interested, but I didn't really at the time think that that was really a career option. I didn't have scientists in my family. I was sort of just more traditional thinking, probably, but then I fortunately had a number of mentors and teachers that sort of opened my eyes to this, in particular this AP biology teacher, Anthony Cabral, who was just this teacher that changed everything because he made me realize, you know, you could do this, you should major in this.
That's really exceptional.
Yeah.
Wow, an AP biology teacher.
Yeah, and so this was senior year, and that's really what led me to think about science and research. And then the neuroscience part, I think, just came from, again, I got at the NIH, my first job was in a neuroscience lab with Doug Fields. So it just goes to show how the path can really change. And the people and the mentors are really critical in sort of shaping the direction that you often go. And I've been definitely very fortunate to have a number of mentors like that along the way.
No, it's fantastic to know and reinforce how important for each
so
of us
important.
To serve as mentors to try to inspire others like you've been. Now, what's really striking is you landed in Boston back where you came from in some respects, but you then go on a fast forward, you're working on glia, and you make this amazing discovery. In fact, above the fold, New York Times, January a year ago, 2016, in schizophrenia and the immune system. So tell us about what was the backstory of that discovery.
Yeah, it's a really exciting backstory. So actually it starts back when I was a postdoc, where I told you I was interested in the role of glia in brain development and brain wiring. And at the time, you know, Ben Barris was looking at the role of glia in this context. And essentially through an unbiased screen, we unexpectedly identified a role for these immune molecules called complement in normal pruning or elimination of synapses, which is a normal developmental process. It's really important for brain wiring. Now back then, this is around 2005-ish, this was a really surprising finding because we really didn't think about immune molecules being in the brain. Most of the time we thought about immune molecules if you have an infection or if there's some breach of the blood-brain barrier. But what was really exciting about this is we discovered a number of these molecules that are traditionally associated with the complement system were actually being expressed in neurons and in healthy glial cells in the normal brain. And what we then discovered was that they played a normal role in this pruning process. So this was, at the time when I started my lab, a perfect way to sort of launch a lab because nothing was known mechanistically. And so the first thing we did over the first 5 years is just to try to dig into that. And we used mouse models, and we sort of, you know, started thinking about how this might work. And that led to our discovery that another immune cell called microglia were at play here.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this is another example of, even as a glial biologist, I completely ignored microglia. And the reason is because these were immune cells, and they weren't really born in the brain. Neurobiologists didn't really think about them in the context of healthy brain. So we put these two ideas together, and realized that the microglia were actually part of this pruning process. And so much of the work we've been doing over the last, 8 years or so have been just sort of digging in on trying to understand how it is that this immune pathway is doing something as important as pruning. Meanwhile, Steve McCarroll, who's led the genetics on that schizophrenia work, he and his student Ashwin Sekar and his lab and colleagues at the Broad were uncovering some genetics that were pointing to the same pathway that we've been studying all these years in a mouse.
And you hadn't had any crosstalk?
No. Of course, I knew Steve's work, but we weren't in the same circles. He's a human geneticist. He's in the genetics department across the street, not that far away. And at the time, I wasn't involved as much in the Broad. And Steve just basically, we had coffee one day. He said, I have these really interesting but very preliminary findings, and knew that I worked on complement in the context of pruning. And then we started having these discussions, really exciting discussions. Mm. This led to our labs having joint lab meetings together, and then bringing in Michael Carroll and his lab, who are immunologists who has been studying complement in the context of immunity and immune system his whole career. And so the three labs started to converge on a very regular basis.
Wow.
And that was around the time where the C4 paper was really starting to come together. Now, the genetics on that was already amazing, beautiful, and important. But what we then did together was started to think about the biological significance and whether or not the C4 genetics could also be linking into the pruning process that we've been studying. And for that, I think the only way to really tackle that is to bring together sort of this interdisciplinary team, which is what's been so exciting.
Actually, this is so extraordinary because the idea that you could get immunology, your neurobiology, human genetics all together and make this momentous discovery and a true mechanistic breakthrough, it's fantastic.
Well,
really. Yeah,
I would say part of it is there was a little bit of serendipity in the sense that, we're all together. And for that to really happen the way it did, all of us being literally one block from another made it really happen. And then, of course, the students become major roles, right? They start working together in the different labs, and then sparks start to fly. And honestly, I think that's why we do this. Like, this is so exciting. And I'd say we're really only at the beginning of really understanding how it's working, but we're really well positioned now to try to make some progress.
Well, and you're on to something that's exceptionally important, which is the immune system in neurologic diseases.
Mm-hmm.
It could extend well beyond the schizophrenia story that you worked on, I'm sure you're working on other areas, but Alzheimer's has been shown recently to have very much involvement in the immune system. And this whole idea that we didn't even know there was the immune system in the brain, and now it's actually somehow linked to many diseases. Do you want to comment about where you think this is going to go, that it's not just relegated to one area?
Yeah, I think that's what I'm most excited about, because I don't think it's one disease. I think what's really exciting about the schizophrenia work is the genetics also told us, pointed to the same pathway. Now, in the case of Alzheimer's, we were also excited about the possibility that this pathway may be relevant in Alzheimer's, because a hallmark of so many neurological disorders, including neurodegenerative diseases of the aged brain, involve the loss of synapses, right, the connections between neurons. In fact, that's the strongest correlate of cognitive decline in Alzheimer's. Mm-hmm. More than plaques and tangles in pathology, it's the synaptic loss, which happens in people presumably years before you start to get the symptoms, and that's also been shown in animal models. So, the same year we started the lab, we took a chance and we hypothesized that maybe the same pathway we've been studying in development could be aberrantly reactivated in the adult brain to mediate the synapse loss. And this was just an idea that came from the work I did as a postdoc, and sort of we started working on this in early days, and now we have evidence that indeed the same pathway that is a good thing during development gets aberrantly turned on in vulnerable brain regions like the hippocampus, an area involved in memory, of course. And then this leads to this early synapse loss, at least in animal models. And so what's even more exciting now is, again, the genetics, because if you look at the new emerging genetic data from the Alzheimer's disease, almost half the genes are immune-related or microglia-related, which, again, is pointing to these cells not just being downstream, but they're actually a major contributor and causal. So now whether or not that relates to the pruning in terms of human AD patients, that's the next big step, is to try to put these ideas together.
Well,
but we really think that this might be a common mechanism that makes synapses vulnerable in a host of diseases, not just one.
Well, we're expecting to see that from you in the future,
I hope so.
Because I think you're on it. And it's really so exciting because, of course, it's been disappointing not to have a breakthrough in Alzheimer's, but maybe because we didn't understand it well enough. And it's fantastic the work that you and your colleagues and your your collaborators are doing. So we hope that you go full force.
Yeah.
And want to thank you, Beth.
Thank
this
you
has been
so
a
much.
Fun
no,
discussion.
Been wonderful.
I'd like
Thanks
to talk
for
to you for
me.
Several more hours. I want to thank everybody in the Medscape community for tuning in on this one-on-one with Beth Stevens. Thank you.